reading Crime and Punishment is very exciting. And I don't say that because I'm a Russian literature professor. I teach a Dostoevsky seminar. We read a lot of Dostoevsky. And about halfway through the term, the students in the class tend to be having, all of them together, very vivid dreams. Because Dostoevsky novels, they play with your mind, right? They get inside your psyche. It really takes students by surprise, but they're also fascinated by it. I had one student who took it with him on a camping trip, and he said afterwards that he'd stayed up all night with a flashlight running through batteries after batteries. Often what we're used to reading is a whodunit, right? Where the crime happens and the reader and the detective both try and figure out who did it. In Russian, the model is a little different. So you could call it like a whydunit. Russians were very interested in the moral implications of crime. Crime was something that was on the rise during this period, and figuring out what the criminal mind is thinking, why the criminal mind works the way it does, was important. The ethical burden placed on the reader is what Dostoevsky is famous for. He gives multiple viewpoints, and he enables you to consider these ethical questions from multiple perspectives. So in the end, you decide.
Welcome to the Blue Hour. I am Farha Guerrero. Tonight I speak with Katia Bowers, Professor of Slavic Studies in the Department of Central, Eastern, and Northern European Studies at the University of British Columbia. She also serves as Vice President of the North American Dostoevsky Society. Katia Bowers specializes in Russian literature and culture of the long 19th century. She has a special interest in genre, imagined geography, as well as digital media and media studies. Her forthcoming book is about the ways in which Russian realist writers engage with Gothic fiction in their work. And also soon off the press is a new volume that she co-edited with Kate Holland, titled Dostoevsky at 200, The Novel in Modernity. But first, let's start the night with a favorite song of hers, this one from the Russian rock band DDT, titled Asinya.
Небеса на коне, на осеннем параде, месят тесто из тех, кто представлен к награде, а по ящику врут о войне. Я живу на весах, в это качество года, моя песня, конечно, дождливого рода. Моя песня не спета и не одета. Моя песня — ответ письмам Анны и Лизы. Брызги ветра висят на промокших карнизах. Собрала их губами весна. С бедой на плечах доползу до дороги. Умереть ничего, если выпить немного, но мешает уйти от тебя. Наше я, где опасность и бред, там живые могилы, нас за верность и хлеб поднимают на вилы. Этой осенью платим за свет, пляшем на виражах повороты веками, и никому нет конца, даже тем, кто не с нами. Наша песня с тобой в облаках, и пока ничего, ничего не случилось. Я вчера еще помнил, что жизнь мне приснилась. Этой осенью стала она. И если вокруг одно лихо, и если кругом слишком тонко, люби всех нас, Господи, тихо, люби всех нас, Господи, громко. Иногда наша жизнь зарастает цветами, это значит, мой друг, он прошел между нами, но увидеть его нелегко. Если вокруг одно лихо и привычное нам, слишком тонко, люби всех нас, Господи, тихо, люби всех нас, Господи, громко, люби всех нас.
Katia Bowers, thank you for joining me tonight. Now, you're a specialist in 19th century Russian literature and culture. What brought you to dedicating your life to this era of literature?
Well, I got started with 19th century Russian literature, not with the literature, which is kind of surprising. I did read 19th century Russian literature in high school. I think a lot of people read 19th century literature in high school. But I read in high school Crime and Punishment, and I ambitiously read War and Peace, and I was never that excited by it. And then I went to university and I started studying Russian. And when I started studying Russian, I got very excited about the language and the music and the culture, and then Russian poetry. And when my Russian finally got good enough to read Russian literature in the original, starting with poetry, I was hooked. So I finished my undergrad and I decided to go to grad school, and I kept studying it, and here I am.
And now, why Russian? Why did you choose Russian as a language to study?
When I went to university, I had already finished my language requirements. I speak German. And my best friend was also going to university, and her grandmother was a Russian speaker. And so she really wanted to learn Russian, but she'd heard that it was hard. And so she figured that because I was already speaking another language, that I could help her with her homework. And so I agreed to take Russian with her, and we continued taking Russian together. And after a while, she decided it wasn't for her. And at that point, I just continued on.
So it was through the Russian language that brought you back into the literature that became. Interesting. And so what was the difference with reading the literature in Russian and understanding in Russian versus reading a translation?
So as I said, I got into the Russian poetry first. And the thing about Russian poetry is that it is, it's kind of like a puzzle, right? So it's, you have the language and then there are rhymes, and the rhymes speak to each other through the meaning of the words in the language. So you can manipulate Russian poetry in a lot of really interesting ways, and you can derive meaning from Russian poetry in a lot of interesting ways by reading more deeply into the language and into the system of roots and into the system of rhymes and other poetic features. And I found that to be really exciting. I had a love for Russian poetry, and I went to grad school first to study Russian poetry. But then I discovered that I had a love for narrative form that went deeper than my love for poetry. I like form, as you can tell. I like rhyme schemes, but also narrative forms, like the novel, or like the way that dialogue functions within a novel. And so I did my PhD on the 19th century Russian novel.
So do you think that when you were first exposed to Russian literature as a youngster in high school, and then later read it as, you know, as an older woman, do you think there later the literature might have spoke to you in different ways when you first read it?
Yeah, I think that, and I see this also with my students who are reading texts for the first time that I read for the first time when I was their age, and then I've read again and again as I've, you know, gotten older. And what you get out of the text is different when you're a young person than when you're an old person. The novel Eugene Onegin, for example, when you read it when you're a young person, it's all about the tragic love story, and it's all very exciting, and there's a lot of emotion there, and you kind of like the cynicism of the main character. But when you read it as an older person, or when you read it as you grow, you start to see the maturity of some of the characters. You start to see the authorial voice coming in and the kind of things that the author was really interested in putting into the text. And you you can see that at one point, one of the characters says, "Oh, you know, I'll be dead by the time I'm 28. At least I hope so. Like, can you imagine being so old?" And when you get to be over 28, that speaks to you differently than it did when you were, you know, 19 and reading it.
Yeah, so it does grow with us, I guess, as we age.
But yeah,
there is something, and I'm sure you've seen this in the many years that you've been studying Russian literature, especially 19th century Russian literature, that it has a kind of magnetic appeal in some way. It sort of draws us in. It brings us deep within. And then in some ways, there is a bit of cult following. A cult following happens around the world where people speakers of all different languages are drawn into this Russian literature, and I will confess, myself included. And why do you think that is? What is the sort of grand appeal of this period in particular that brings so many readers in?
Well, I think that one of the things that a lot of the kind of, so I would say that there's a certain group of popular Russian novels that are read kind of like the Russian classics. And this is not necessarily true of all Russian novels that were published in the 19th century. There are thousands of novels that were published in the 19th century in Russia that have never been translated, that we don't read a lot of in other cultures because they're simply not available, right? Some of them have not been published since the 19th century, so they haven't been reprinted. But I think that a lot of those novels that have been reprinted and have been discussed over and over again and have gone into different cultures, they have a kind of universal quality about them. The Russian writers were often very concerned with the human's place in the world, or the individual's place in the world. And they wrote books that spoke to the experience of the individual in a way that I think crosses borders, crosses experiences. So that, for example, when you're reading Anna Karenina, you don't have to know what it was like for a 19th century married woman to find that Anna or another character from the novel really speaks to you. But some of the psychological experiences that she was
was having, the emotional experiences that she was having, those are what speak to you. And those are what the 19th century writers were so good at writing.
And so in that sense, many of the themes that they dealt with are in many ways still relevant today.
Yes, absolutely. And I should say this is not unique to Russian literature, but there is this great collection of novels that do have these themes that still resonate today that have come from the Russian 19th century.
Well, let's listen quickly to, he's a past professor of yours, Erwin Weil is his name, and we're going to listen to him and his beginnings into Russian literature and what drew him in, specifically Dostoevsky, which I hope we will spend a great deal of our time today talking about.
Since the time of the Renaissance, there's probably no single writer who has had as profound and deep an influence on contemporary writers, or writers for that matter, throughout the 20th century, as the one we're going to talk about now, Fyodor Mikhailovich Dostoevsky. His force is enormous, his influence is far-reaching, and when people think about serious literature today, most often Dostoevsky is the first name that comes to mind. Here you're going to have to pardon me just a little bit, because there's something personal I feel I have to tell you. Dostoevsky was responsible for my learning the Russian language. When I was an undergraduate student at the University of Chicago, they had us read a novel of a man and a novel I'd never heard of before. It was called The Brothers Karamazov. I read it and I was overwhelmed. I wondered who was this person who wrote such powerful literature. They told me, if you like that, get a book called Crime and Punishment. I went to the bookstore, said, well, do you have something called Crime and Punishment? They laughed in my face, gave me the book. I started reading it in the dormitory room. The next thing I knew, it was the next day. My eyes were as big as saucers, and I was finishing the book. It made a powerful impression on me, and I decided that I would like to read not the words of a translator, but the original words of Dostoevsky, and consequently signed up for a course in the Russian language, which I began to study at that point, and of course I've been studying ever since. And to my amazement, I learned there was not only a certain Dostoevsky, but a certain Pushkin, a certain Tolstoy, a certain Gogol, a certain Turgenev, a certain Chekhov. And the next thing I knew, I was perhaps ankle deep, perhaps neck deep in Russian literature. So, of course, I'm very grateful to Dostoevsky and still very much under his influence.
So, Katya Bowers, you knew Erwin Weil from Northwestern University, is that right?
Yes. By the time I was at Northwestern, he was retired, but still very much present in the department. So he would come to events. He still goes to conferences. He's very active. And of course, I've had conversations with him. I really like his story about Dostoevsky and learning Russian, because it seems to me this kind of example of, so I read it through all night, and then, you know, I discovered there was a Pushkin and a Gogol and a Chekhov and all of these writers, and that is kind of what happened to me too. I had the Russian language and then the poets, and then I realized that there was all of this literature, and it's a slippery slope. Once you get into it, it's hard to stop.
It's hard to stop. And it's also hard to stop because there's just so much wealth. And you, as you said earlier, not many of these necessarily writers are translated to this day. But at the same time, what has been translated is just enormous. There's just enormous wealth. So let's talk about Dostoevsky. Who is Dostoevsky? And why is he so important to the world of literature?
So Dostoevsky was a 19th century Russian writer. He was born in 1821 and he died in 1881. And over the course of his life, he produced a number of books, five major novels, which were all written within the last 20 years of his life. He had remarkable life experiences. So one experience that he had was that he was almost executed as a young man. He was, at the time, there was very strict censorship in Russia, and he was active in a literary circle that had a printing press, an illegal printing press. And as a result, the members of the, and this is a very shortened version of this story, but more or less, the members of the literary society were all arrested. They were sentenced to death. At the last moment, the Tsar pardoned them. But I mean, really at the last moment when the firing squad had gotten up and started aiming at the first group of prisoners to be executed, and the Dostoevsky was in the second group. And there's an urban legend about this. Well, there's a kind of apocryphal legend about this, which is that, you know, one person went completely insane from this experience. One person's hair turned completely white from this experience. And one person was Dostoevsky. Became Dostoevsky the writer. And then also after that, Dostoevsky served in a labor camp and then in the military in Siberia for 10 years. So he was exiled for 10 years and incarcerated before he came back. And this experience profoundly changed his life. So before all of this, he was writing fiction, and his fiction was good. The fiction was very interesting, but they were not as psychologically probing, not the same depth as the mature Dostoevsky. And when he came back, he wrote first Notes from the House of the Dead, which is his novel about prison camp life, and then Notes from Underground, and then in short order, Crime and Punishment, The Idiot, Demons, The Adolescent Brothers Karamazov within a 15-year span, which is really remarkable.
It's incredibly remarkable because each of those texts is really a grand work of literature, even the shorter ones.
Yeah, perhaps. Absolutely.
And so Dostoevsky is this person that is known, you know, really all over the world in many ways. There are active societies, and you are vice president of the North American Dostoevsky yes. Society. Now, who is part of these societies, and what do these societies aim to do?
So I can't speak about all the societies, but in terms of the North American Dostoevsky Society and the International Dostoevsky Society, which the other societies and the North American Society are also kind of subsidiaries of, the membership is made up of first Dostoevsky scholars, Dostoevsky students, but also interested readers. So we have a wide membership that are people who like Dostoevsky and like the kind of events that we do and like the kind of outreach that we have and like to read our journal. And so they also become members of the society. And we try to make it as welcoming as possible, whether you are a scholar or whether you are just an extremely excited reader. There's something for you in the society.
So it's a big mix of people that just love yes. Dostoevsky and love not only his literature, but I would imagine even more. So maybe looking at his life and biography, this kind of memoir, traces of memoirs that he left as well. Yes. And so going back to your position at the University of British Columbia, in 2016, you actually put together quite an interesting project about Dostoevsky to commemorate the 150th anniversary since the publication of Crime and Punishment. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so when I moved to Canada, I was very excited because my colleague and friend Kate Holland was already working in Canada. She's a professor at the University of Toronto, and she's also a Dostoevsky specialist. And we, at the very first conference I went to, which was like a week after I started my job in January of 2015, we started plotting, and we thought, oh, you know, we can apply for a grant from the Social Science Humanities Research Council of Canada, and we can get this grant and we can celebrate Dostoevsky. And there's this anniversary of the sesquicentenary anniversary of the novel Crime and Punishment coming up. And let's just be really creative and figure out what we can do. And so we tied in digital exhibits. Both her students and my students wrote library exhibits. My students' library exhibit was published and is still on the University of Cambridge website, which hosts it, Cambridge University Library. We did a creative Twitter project where we and some other colleagues of ours tweeted all of Crime and Punishment from Raskolnikov's perspective over the course of 2 years. Most of Crime and Punishment takes place in 3 weeks in July. So we started tweeting in July 2016. And then the epilogue takes place over 18 months after that. So we followed Raskolnikov to Siberia and went onwards. And these projects are all archived on our project website, which you can find at blogs.ubc.ca/CP150. We had a virtual film series where people watched movies that were available on Netflix at home, and we live tweeted about them using our hashtag. So a lot of fun stuff like that too. There was an online group read, and then we culminated all of this with a conference, which was open to basically anyone who had anything to say about adapting, teaching, or reading Dostoevsky. And we had a very nice conference for a couple of days at Green College. And we're excited because these projects, they never seem to end. But we finally have gotten the last of the conference videos edited. So there will be a video archive of the presentations from that conference going up relatively soon.
Well, that's exciting. Tell me a little more about us, a little more about the Twitter project, because that's just a fascinating concept, the idea that in a way you're tweeting out what would really be the voice of this main character, Raskolnikov.
Yes. So the project is called @RadionTweets, and you can still find it on Twitter. We've also archived it, so you can read the tweets. If you read it on Twitter, it reads backwards, right? So the most recent tweets are first, so you get the end of the book first. But if you read the archived version, you get the first tweets first, so you can read it in chronological order and read it alongside the novel. And so we had been inspired by this by an earlier Twitter project that I had done as part of a North American Dostoevsky Society event in November of 2015. And that project celebrated the novel The Double, which was Dostoevsky's second novel. It's a confusing novel, but I think a really rewarding novel. It was published in 1846. And what we wanted to do for that event was have an event where the public read the novel. We talked about it online, and then we all had a group viewing of the Richard Ioade film from 2013, The Double, which is fantastic, by the way. Everyone should watch it. And talk about that on a Twitter hashtag. So we called it #TheDoubleEvent. It was all very lovely. And one of the things that my colleague Brian Armstrong thought was that we should have a kind of gimmicky something on social media leading up to this. And so we decided to tweet The Double from the protagonist Yakov Galyadkin's perspective. So we tweeted at Yakov Galyadkin for a number of days in October, November 2014 or 2015. We went through the whole novel, and this was very popular. We were really kind of surprised at how popular it was, but we were also really surprised at how rewarding it was to read the novel on such a close level that you have to do when you're doing this kind of tweet mining experience. So, because in order to extract the tweets from the novel, you have to really think about who's the main character, what's his perspective, what's the narrator doing, what's the narrative voice, all of this. It becomes an exercise in literary analysis, which we hadn't quite anticipated. And so we tweeted out The Double, and we were so excited by it, we decided to do a much larger scale, and of course, Crime and Punishment is a larger novel, Twitter project, and that became @RadionTweets.
Well, it's a fascinating example of using technology, the technology that we have today, to bring out works like, you know, the ones you've mentioned, these classic works that, you know, that are 150 years old, mm-hmm. And yet still resonate with everyone. And also, I guess it's another way for students, even in your class, because I know some of them participated as well, right?
Yes.
And, yeah. So
yeah, absolutely.
For the younger generation to be able to see and understand Russian literature in ways that are more familiar to them.
What I thought was really interesting, especially about the Twitter projects, and particularly about the Crime and Punishment Twitter project, and I mean, this is common sense, but I hadn't expected it somehow, is that so when you tweet out a novel, you have all the tweets in a line for yourself, right? So you tweet them out, and on the account, all the tweets just appear from that account. But when they go out into people's timelines, they mix with everything else that's happening on Twitter. So you might get, you know, a tweet from a friend, and then a tweet about a news story, and then tweets about some kind of event that's happening. And then suddenly Raskolnikov pops up in your Twitter feed. And that can be disconcerting, but also created a lot of very strange, intense Twitter moments that people who were following along on the feed were reflecting on as the feed went along. So we were tweeting, as I said, in July 2016. So it started, there were some early tweets in June 2016. Most of it was in July 2016. And then it continued on after that. And what was happening, if you recall, in June and July 2016 were Brexit, for one, the Brexit vote took place. And for two, the Trump's rise in the through speeches, culminating in his speech at the Republican National Convention. And so it happened that Raskolnikov's, this is a little bit of a spoiler for the novel. People listening, if you're going to read the novel, stop listening now and come back in a minute. So Raskolnikov, at the end of the novel, sorry, spoilers, he goes to confess his crime, and he has this kind of long kind of psychological internal monologue about his concerns, about the anxiety around confessing the crime leading up to that confession. And that coincided with everyone live tweeting Trump's speech with a fair amount of anxiety during the Republican National Convention in July. And that was a very strange experience. Like, we hadn't planned it. We loaded the tweets in weeks before. We didn't know that was happening, but it was exactly timed to that. It was very weird.
That's fascinating. And so a few years ago, when you edited a Dostoevsky companion volume, mm-hmm. I know that you wanted to include some of this digital material, but of course it was difficult to do that. But it's something that you've thought about, how you can incorporate this more, this type of information that and reactions. I mean, this is all really interesting stuff when we're thinking about how people are learning about Russian literature.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that I'm working on now, which I can't say a lot about because it's not official yet, is there is a press that is interested in publishing a literature Twitterature edition of The Double. So it would include the translation of The Double by Constance Garnett, which is in the public domain, and then also our Twitter feed. So that's kind of in progress right now, which I don't know if it will happen, but I hope it will.
That's great. And what also is actually coming out pretty soon is another forthcoming book that you've edited. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So Kate Holland and I have one of the things that we talked about in that conversation in 2015 when I first started my job was, yes, the upcoming Crime and Punishment celebration, but also bigger still, the impending bicentenary of Dostoevsky's birth, which is this year, 2021. And we knew that we wanted to do something big for it. And so one of the things that we wanted to do was an edited volume, which we have called Dostoevsky at 200, The Novel in Modernity. And this volume, it's coming out in July with University of Toronto Press. It collects essays on Dostoevsky that is really cutting edge for what the field is doing in North America right now. These are by scholars mostly from North America, but also including a scholar from Russia, a scholar from Britain. And they are mostly early career or recently established academics who are really exploring for the first time some of these methodologies that they're using. And it's a really exciting volume. And so we're excited to see it come to light. We also have an idea for a public outreach program similar to Crime and Punishment at 150 that will be happening in the fall, and we're starting to plan that now, which will be a more public, less scholarly celebration of Dostoevsky.
So let's now dig into a little bit more about this kind of effect that Dostoevsky has. At the start, we listened to one of mm-hmm. your students who'd read Crime and Punishment for the first time, staying up all night with a flashlight while he was camping. What other stories have you heard from students as you're teaching this class? Because the sense that I get is that somewhere halfway, right, in the middle of the semester or so, you start to notice that the students really are getting engaged with, say, your course on Dostoevsky, you know, where they're getting really deeply sort of drawn in to these texts.
Yes. So my course on Dostoevsky, it has too many books in it, but I can't help that because Dostoevsky has written a lot of books. And I tell students this up front. I say, you know, this semester, you're going to be reading a lot of Dostoevsky. But the result is that my students are usually reading about 200 pages of Dostoevsky a week, 200 to 250 pages of Dostoevsky a week, in order to read all the novels in the class. And the class does have 5 novels in it. Some of them are shorter, but we do read, in addition to the short novels, in very quick succession, Crime and Punishment, The Idiot, and The Brothers Karamazov. And if you have read these novels, even just one of these novels, it's an intense experience. And so students who come into my class and are reading, they're kind of immersed in this much Dostoevsky over the course of the semester, they start to, especially when they're up at night reading, they will start dreaming very vividly about Dostoevsky and then come into class and they would share their dreams, and they started all kind of dreaming the same things about halfway through the class, which I thought was very peculiar. And the things were tied to passages from Dostoevsky that they'd been reading. But still, I mean, the dreams that come from reading Dostoevsky novels are unsettling at best. So that was a very peculiar experience. One of my favorite quotes about Dostoevsky is from Virginia Woolf, and specifically from her essay, The Russian Point of View. And she says, quote, "The novels of Dostoevsky are seething whirlpools, gyrating sandstorms, waterspouts which hiss and boil and suck us in. They are composed purely and wholly of the stuff of the soul. Against our wills, we are drawn in, whirled round, blinded, suffocated, and at the same time filled with a giddy rapture." And I think that pretty much sums it up. That's what I feel reading Dostoevsky, and I think that's what my students begin to feel too once they've kind of immersed themselves in that much Dostoevsky a week.
So we're going to listen now to a woman named Anne Ruska, who's speaking at the University of California in Berkeley, where she talks about Dostoevsky's mock execution in 1849 and its connection to his writings later in his life.
Start by talking about an incident in Dostoevsky's life that I think is helpful in thinking about 19th century literature and what literature does or wants to do. So Dostoevsky, this is in 1849. Dostoevsky was 28 years old. He was arrested. He was arrested for being a member of a secret political circle. And the thing that had brought him into that political circle was his hatred of serfdom, which was essentially Russian slavery and was the social law of the land in Russia at that time. Dostoevsky was a lifelong enemy of serfdom, which he saw as a great evil. But in the late 1840s, it was essentially illegal and impossible to publicly criticize serfdom. So that was what brought him into this secret political circle. The thing is, though, that in the late 1840s, it was also illegal to be a member of a secret political circle. So Dostoevsky was arrested, held in prison for months along with other members of this circle, and finally given his sentence, which was death by firing squad. He was led with the other prisoners out to where the execution was to take place. Three of the prisoners were stood in front of the firing squad with bags on their heads. At that moment, a messenger arrived from the Tsar at the last minute to tell the prisoners that their sentence had been changed. They were not to be executed. Instead, they were given other sentences. Dostoevsky was sentenced finally to 4 years in the labor camp and several years of exile after that. So, when Dostoevsky came back from prison and exile 10 years later in 1859, he came with a very strong sense of what it is that literature is supposed to do, what it is that we need from literature. Literature needs to explain these things that are so bizarre that they shouldn't happen. Things like serfdom, where one person can own another as if that person were a thing, or the fact that life can be taken from you. When you're only 28 and not ready to have it be taken, it can be taken from you for no reason. And then, also for no reason, suddenly given back to you. It's absurd. Or it's miraculous. Or it's both absurd and miraculous at the same time. And literature needs to try to help us understand that. And I I think that we can talk about really two big questions of 19th century Russian literature. One is, what is the nature of life in the face of death? Big question. But, you know, we all have to die, so why do we live? And the other is, what does literature mean? And these questions, what is the nature of life and what is the nature of literature, tend to go hand in hand.
Katia Bowers, what do you think Anne Reszka is right about the kind of sort of these bigger, deeper themes, life, death, came out in Dostoevsky's later works, as many of the novels that you teach in your classes were written after that mock execution. Do you think that his experiences being in, you know, Siberia and labor camps and all of these things really had a profound effect on his writing?
Yes, I think so. So the big questions that Anne mentions in her talk, what is life and what is literature, right? What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of literature? These are the questions that really inform a lot of literary production in 19th century. These are the questions that guide most of the large novels that we're familiar with, right? The so-called cursed questions, because there aren't really answers to these questions, right? We don't know what the meaning of life is. And the difference between Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, which people often ask me, is that, you know, their take on what the meaning of life is different. And they get at it through these long philosophical novels. And if you read Pushkin's novels, his take on the meaning of life is different again. One thing that this experience definitely gave to Dostoevsky is a kind of deep appreciation for life and for living, and two, a strong sense of urgency in his later works, which I think is one of the reasons why his works are so feverish and so frenetic in the way that they address these questions and kind of attack these questions to try and find answers to them.
His works are arguably taught not just in literature classes. They are often taught in classes of philosophy, classes of psychology. Why do you think that is?
Dostoevsky's novels are philosophical novels, and they are also psychological novels. And Dostoevsky's characters have been used as case studies by psychologists, just as Dostoevsky's novels have inspired philosophers and served as case studies for philosophers to develop their ideas. So Dostoevsky, in some sense, is, I wouldn't say foundational, but he is certainly an important figure in both of these fields. But reading a Dostoevsky novel as a philosopher and reading a Dostoevsky novel as a psychologist and reading a Dostoevsky novel for the pleasure of reading it, these are very different things. And I find often my students in particular who've read Dostoevsky in philosophy classes have only read parts of Dostoevsky. So they've read The Grand Inquisitor, but they haven't read the entire Brothers Karamazov. Or they've read the first part of Notes from Underground, but not the second part. And you're only getting part of the idea if you do that, because Dostoevsky planned his novels carefully to really explore these ideas in depth. And yes, the Grand Inquisitor is important, but the Grand Inquisitor is not the most important idea in the Brothers Karamazov. So I feel that limiting it, yes, they're shorter, but limiting these to just those excerpts really limit your understanding of Dostoevsky's philosophy.
But in either case, depending on how you choose to read the novel, even as you said, for people that read his works for pleasure, you're still finding that he gets into your head, as you said, with the dreams and everything. And so these deep issues, and he's a deep thinker, I think you could say, right? I think when we read him, we can't help but going to these deeper and often darker places of our minds, or in a way you may find through him those dark places that you didn't even know existed inside you.
Yes. There's a kind of myth. The way that Tolstoy structures a novel is different than the way Dostoevsky structures a novel. Yes, they're both long Russian novels of the 19th century. And yes, they're both doing a lot of character development, etc. And yes, they're both writing in realism, but these are very different creatures, a Dostoevsky novel and a Tolstoy novel. And I find that my students that really love Dostoevsky, the thing that draws them in is the fact that Dostoevsky lets you place value on the things in the novel based on your own judgment, right? He leaves the choices open to you on how that meaning comes out of the novel. Whereas students that really love Tolstoy really love the fact that Tolstoy has this omnipotent kind of voice, narrative voice in his texts, and he will explain to you exactly what he means multiple times, right? So it's very easy to get these kind of life-affirming pronouncements out of Tolstoy novels because they're right there. They're easy to get out. Whereas with Dostoevsky, you have to read more deeply into them. They're a little more subtle and you have to decide what's most meaningful for you. And that, I think, if you're a Dostoevsky person, it creates a very deep experience with the text, a very intensive experience with the text, because you become a part of the text.
I think it's time now to hear reading from one of his most well-known novels, Crime and Punishment. This one comes from the master narrator, George Guido, who his book is available on Audiobook Classics on YouTube, free on YouTube. You can listen to his readings in three different parts. This is actually from the beginning of the novel. So this is really what, you know, the first few pages or a couple pages, I imagine. And I was, when I began reading Crime and Punishment, I was drawn in just from those first pages. And I think that's one of the things that the effect that he has is mm-hmm. why people can't put his book down, because he brings you in right from the start. So let's have a listen.
Chapter 1. On an exceptionally hot evening, early in July, a young man came out of the garret in which he lodged in S Place, and walked slowly, as though in hesitation, towards K Bridge. He had successfully avoided meeting his landlady on the staircase. His garret was under the roof of a high, five-storied house, and was more like a cupboard than a room. The landlady, who provided him with garret, dinners, and attendance, lived on the floor below. And every time he went out, he was obliged to pass her kitchen, the door of which invariably stood open. And each time he passed, the young man had a sick, frightened feeling, which made him scowl and feel ashamed. He was hopelessly in debt to his landlady, and was afraid of meeting her. This was not because he was cowardly and abject, quite the contrary. But for some time past, he had been in an overstrained, irritable condition, verging on hypochondria. He had become so completely absorbed in himself and isolated from his fellows that he dreaded meeting not only his landlady, but anyone at all. He was crushed by poverty, but the anxieties of his position had of late ceased to weigh upon him. He had given up attending to matters of practical importance. He had lost all desire to do so. Nothing that any landlady could do had a real terror for him, but to be stopped on the stairs, to be forced to listen to her trivial, irrelevant gossip, to pestering demands for payment, threats and complaints, and to rack his brains for excuses, to prevaricate, to lie. No. Rather than that, he would creep down the stairs like a cat and slip out unseen. This evening, however, on coming out into the street, he became acutely aware of his fears. "I want to attempt a thing like that, and am frightened by these trifles," he thought, with an odd smile. Yes. All is in a man's hands, and he lets it all slip from cowardice. That's an axiom. It would be interesting to know what it is men are most afraid of. Taking a new step, uttering a new word is what they fear most. But I am talking too much. It's because I chatter that I do nothing. Or perhaps it is that I chatter because I do nothing. I've learned to chatter this last month, lying for days together in my den, thinking of Jack the Giant Killer. Why am I going there now? Am I capable of that? Is that serious? It is not serious at all. It's simply a fantasy to amuse myself, a plaything, yes. Maybe it is a plaything.
It really is mesmerizing to listen to the beginning.
Yes, absolutely.
It actually gives me tingles. And that's the kind of effect I think that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. Right away, you are drawn into the mind of the person. You have the scene. It's typical, a scene that we follow through in the novel. And it's a scene that is very repetitive. Even to this day in St. Petersburg, you can do a tour, I believe called the Steps of Dostoevsky, where you can trace Raskolnikov's footsteps. Is that right?
Yep.
Do you know about that?
Yeah, that is true. I have actually once on study abroad, I went on study abroad in 2003 with a group of American students. And one of the things that we had to do as part of the program was this tour, Dostoevsky's Footsteps, where you trace Raskolnikov's path from his apartment to the old woman's apartment. What the tour organizers or the university organizers did not realize is that the one they signed us up for was a drinking tour. So we traced the footsteps of Raskolnikov while stopping in pubs along the way, which, considering that Dostoevsky had first thought to name the novel The Drunkard, The Drunkards, I found quite funny.
What was it like to do that? Did it feel sort of like you were in the novel again?
It did not feel like I was in the novel, but that was because I was in a large group of American students and going to different pubs. So that there were some differences,
yeah.
But I will say that this is one of the things I find really fascinating about St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg is a place where the literature comes alive. So a lot of St. Petersburg still looks like it, certainly central St. Petersburg still looks a lot like it did when Dostoevsky was living there, when Pushkin was living there. And you can go down side streets and you feel like you're right in the 19th century. And certainly we were able to go, you can't do this anymore because they've closed it off because they got too many tour groups coming, but you can actually go up the stairwell where Dostoevsky of the 19th century building, where Dostoevsky set the murder. And you can go outside the old woman's apartment and you can see the very door. I'm sure it's a reproduction door, right? But there are people living there because it's their apartment building in central St. Petersburg. And there's a lot of graffiti all over the building that people have left who are fans of Crime and Punishment. And I find this fascinating.
It really is. And when we think of Dostoevsky, when we think of some of these scenes in St. Petersburg, what's really also fascinating is so much of the story actually unfolds in these rooms, namely the small mm-hmm. room that this impoverished, very, very poor Raskolnikov actually lived in. And when we talk about small, we're talking really small. And what's incredible is that in this small room, so much happens.
Yes.
And to think that an author can do that, to have an ability to bring so much into a room, into a small room, whether it's in what's going on in his mind or what actually is happening, because people do come in and out of that mm-hmm. room. But it is quite fascinating that...
Yes, this is something that Dostoevsky does quite deliberately in the novel, because just as Raskolnikov feels trapped because the narrative space is so tight, right? We also begin to feel trapped. So we get a kind of sense almost of being stifled or claustrophobia from reading about this one space so intently.
Yes, and hence the dreams that you might have while you're reading this literature. Let's just also listen to another scholar. He's one of the big biographers of Dostoevsky. He's the late Joseph Frank. He was an American literary scholar and leading expert on Dostoevsky. Hear him talk about the relevance that Dostoevsky has today in our modern world.
Stanford University.
For one thing, he invented the mystery story. So when you read him, you're carried along as if you were reading literature on the most popular sort of level. But the fact is that he's a writer who really succeeded in raising those crime stories and the other elements of his work to a level in which they rival, at least in my opinion, and I think it's the opinion of a lot of other people, they rival, the heights of tragedy. But the fact is that, there are certain absolutely fundamental issues which are a part of Western culture anyway, and which keep returning again and again and again. And I think the great writers always express these issues in their own individual way. And he's one of the few novelists who does this. And it's impossible to escape or avoid those issues which keep coming up in their own way in Dostoevsky's works, and that's why he's still a bestseller.
Katia Bowers, do you agree that Dostoevsky is still a bestseller today?
Yes, absolutely. And this is actually a really interesting quote that you selected, because this is something that I love to talk about, which is the way that Dostoevsky constructs narrative. And I talked a little bit earlier about how I get very excited about form, narrative form. But my research and the book that I have coming out hopefully later this year is precisely about the way that Dostoevsky and other 19th century writers used elements, narrative snippets, narrative devices from Gothic fiction in their work. And Dostoevsky was very masterful at this. He used narrative pieces, ways of building up suspense from a lot of different genres that were all popular. So he was using crime fiction. He was a pioneer of crime fiction. He was very interested in reading detective stories. He was interested in reading Gothic fiction. He was reading Gothic fiction, romances, suspense novels, like all of these different genres that were popular, but not necessarily highbrow in the 19th century. And what he's able to create out of them is a philosophical novel that is a page turner, right? Because he uses these devices to make his work have a rhythm about it that keeps you reading.
So you're not finished with Dostoevsky, from what I can tell. There's still a lot.
I feel like Dostoevsky is not finished with me. I think when I started my dissertation, the first thing that drew me into it was Dostoevsky's novel, The Idiot. And I will tell you that I have read The Idiot now, I don't know how many times. I teach The Idiot at least twice a year. I read The Idiot every time I teach it, and other times as well. I basically have the novel memorized at this point, and I still can't figure out what I think about it. So I keep going back to it because it still has mysteries. And I think that really speaks to Dostoevsky's both staying power, or maybe just my obsession with The Idiot, I don't know. both Dostoevsky's staying power and the richness of his novels, that there's so much there to gather.
Well, you have a chapter in this new book that's going to come out for the bicentennial, and it's actually where you're looking at the Holbein painting, which is a painting that is described in The Idiot, but also comes from a personal experience that Dostoevsky had with that painting. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. So my poor students always get confronted with this painting in class. I like to I like to project it very large on a screen in the front of the class, and then we talk about it. But it's a horrifying painting. It's terrifying. And basically, this is Hans Holbein the Younger's painting of dead Christ in the tomb. And Dostoevsky encountered this painting when he was in Basel, Switzerland in 1867. So as he was just starting to think and put together the ideas of the idiot, and he was incredibly struck by this painting. So he was touring through a gallery with his wife, Anna Grigorievna, and he became so fascinated by the painting that he just kept standing there. And so she went and she left and she left him and she toured the rest of the gallery. And then she came back to find him hours later and he was still standing there. And she writes about it. It was such a striking experience that she writes about it twice in her once in her memoir and once in her diary. And she says, you know, he was standing there and he looked like he was about to have an epileptic fit. So I had to take him and physically remove him from where he could see the painting in order to remove him from this experience that he was having. And what the painting is it is a life-size framed painting of a dead body laid out. And it's supposed to be, it's called Dead Christ in the Tomb, and it's supposed to be Jesus dead laying out in the tomb. But the thing that Dostoevsky could not stop looking at, and the thing that fascinates Dostoevsky throughout The Idiot, is the fact that the way that Jesus is depicted is as if he is mortal. So he is starting to decay, and there are bruises and there are cuts, and his eyes are open and glassy, and, you know, I mean, it's a corpse, right? And that existential terror that painting brought up in him, I believe, is the existential terror that drives The Idiot. And that's what my chapter is about.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. I myself, I'll be honest with you, when I was reading The Idiot, it was that painting that I had to go and look at and research. And so I wish I could be one of your students in your class, because I would think that would be amazing.
My students invariably have intense experiences with dead Christ in the tomb, but I'm not sure if that's good or bad. It is what it is. But the chapter and the book, I should say, it isn't official on the website yet, but it will be available open access thanks to the University of Toronto Library when it is published. So you should be able to read it, and everyone can read it.
Do you want to just give us the full title again?
Yes, the book is called Dostoevsky at 200, The Novel in Modernity. And it is co-edited by me and my colleague, Kate Holland.
Well, thank you, Katia Bowers. I really appreciate your time tonight. And
well, thank you for having me.
Been tuned into an episode of The Blue Hour on CITR, the broadcasting voice of the University of British Columbia. CITR began as a student club in 1937 and gained a place on the FM dial in 1982. My name is Farha Guerrero. I'm the volunteer host and producer of The Blue Hour. You can download The Blue Hour podcasts on CITR and also subscribe to them on Spotify and iTunes. My guest today was Katia Bowers. You can learn more about her research on Russian literature and culture from the Department of Central Eastern and Northern European Studies at UBC, and on their website at cenes.ubc.ca. We're going to end today's show with another favorite song of hers, this one by Metric, titled Help, I'm Alive. Thank you for listening tonight.
I tremble. Are you a current UBC grad student? If so, then listen up, because the Graduate Student Society lets UBC grads book rooms and spaces in the newly renovated grad student building. Be sure to take advantage of what the facility has to offer. The rooms come equipped with sound systems and can host up to 300 people. Even better, as grad students, you don't have to pay booking fees. Not a grad? Don't worry. The Tia Corner House is open to the public, as in the Kerner Pub, opening earlier next year. For more information, contact booking manager Rob at bookings@gss.ubc.ca.